It may not be a matter of digging up bones when we're talking about New Testament biblical archaeological research, but there is still plenty to be found if one knows where to dig. We'll talk about a guy who does, Dr. Titus Kennedy, next, and we'll continue to explore whatever undergirds the nativity story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with Dr. Titus Kennedy, the book is Unearthing the Bible, and it is a wonderful survey using photographs and contextual information that provides a background on all of the archaeological evidence that exists and how it coincides with the biblical narratives. We were talking about specifically the nativity story. And Titus, if I could, I want to back up a little bit because this is where it gets kind of confusing. And there seems that we get into, even as a devout Christian, we kind of get into this realm of, well, just go with it. So, we have slightly different versions of the stories in Matthew and Luke, which makes it sometimes difficult to, we have to judge which one do we want to go with in order to establish a credibility line. But even if we go with both of them simultaneously, that it gets complicated when we talk about, okay, so they had to go back to the census for a census. King Herod would give, put out a census. So they go back to Bethlehem, but there's no, they have no family that were willing to take them in. So they're forced to get a room in a manger, which is then actually a cave as opposed to the creche, the way that we usually show it. And the three wise men come that night following the star in the sky that says the King of Kings has been born. And yet, as you said later on, actually, that the death decree didn't come until some unspecified time later on, the decree from King Herod, supposedly, that said, I want to kill all the male children in Bethlehem because there is a child that is born there that would usurp his crown in an earthly sense. So let's help me reconcile the arrival of the three wise men as we traditionally understand it, bringing frankincense and myrrh to the just born Jesus.
Yeah, so obviously there's some different ideas about that, and I would say that a lot of the nativity scenes, they sort of just merge everything. But if you look at Matthew, the end of chapter one, that sort of ends the birth narrative. Matthew doesn't get into all those details like Luke does, so they sort of fill gaps in for each other. And I think that there's a space of time between Matthew 1 and Matthew 2, and you got to put Luke's account in there. And so Matthew 2:1 says, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. So this is after that sometime. They go to Jerusalem first, then they hear that it's supposed to have happened in Bethlehem. So then they get led to the house, which I would say that's they're back in Nazareth by that time.
See, that's where it
So,
gets confusing, right? Because
yeah.
that now we're saying, okay, now they're back in Nazareth, not in Bethlehem, and there's no objective way of judging that. We're just trying to reconcile in the synoptic gospels, we're trying to reconcile these disparate narratives and make them fit together, which is all well and good. I'm not saying we can't do that, but there is nothing that we can unearth that says, oh, this would be how that would have worked, or that there was definitely, we have evidence that King Herod decided to kill babies in that year because he felt threatened. That just doesn't exist. And is there any specific archaeological evidence or any objective data concerning the three wise men or three kings?
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff about the Magi, but there's nothing that's extremely definitive. Basically, we have this other source that was fairly recently discovered, or again, sort of rediscovered, an old manuscript called The Revelation of the Magi that we think might have been composed in the 2nd century AD. And it's basically talking about the Magi who visited Jesus and giving more in-depth information on them. You know, how much we can take of this historical, we don't know, but it talks about the Magi, and there's basically at least 12 of them.
They not come three.
Right. Well, you know, we don't actually know how many there were. In Matthew, it never specifies. The three just comes from the three different groups, but there's some group of Magi, and, you know, this old text indicates that there were more. And it's our earliest source that is saying that there is some kind of number of them.
Okay.
So they were these, if we look at what Magi were, you know, they're these guys who would be kind of like scientists / religious scholars and advisors. So they're smart guys, you know, they're melding what they know of science at the time with religion. They're really into the stars, which is why they're following the star.
Right.
And yeah, they end up going to see Jesus. But yeah, we just don't have much information about them. We don't even know exactly where they came from. It's probably, you know, they're Persian, but there's possibilities that they came from, say, Babylon, for example, too.
Right. And that would make more sense that they came from Babylon, in the sense that, I mean, this is where, again, people think that there is no such thing as biblical astrology, or to study astrology today would be unbiblical, when really, as you're pointing out, it wasn't astronomy. They were reading the stars. They were looking for signs in the stars. And that was different. Now, do we know from any astronomical evidence that there would have been a star that shone brightly over that part of Judea that would have been significant at the time that people might have been drawn to it, other than, say, Venus, right, which is always the brightest star in the sky? Was there anything else that we can get to from the astronomical evidence that you know about?
There are theories about that, conjunctions of planets and things like this. Personally, I don't think that's what the text of Matthew is talking about, though. To me, okay, it actually sounds more like it's some kind of divine light or an angel. Kind of, again, you were talking about Moses, right? Go back to the Exodus story and God leading them in the pillar of fire by night, right? Well, they're getting led to a specific house, and a star doesn't do that. But an angel does, which in Greek, it can be the same word. And again, this revelation of the Magi from the 2nd century, it talks about the star in the same terms, like it's some kind of angelic being also. And we have this sort of idea in ancient Greek literature too. So I'm leaning more towards that's what Matthew's trying to communicate, rather than they were calculating, you know, exactly where to go by a star.
Okay. Perfect. And thank you, by the way. This is really helpful. Again, we're talking with Dr. Titus Kennedy, and Unearthing the Bible is his new book. It's a compendium of photographs and contextual information, very readable, very understandable, about the 101, as you have them, archaeological discoveries that bring the Bible to life, which I think is a good subtitle, because you don't say what some people might insist you would have said, which is that it proves the Bible is true, which, as we're discussing, becomes problematic when we're really getting, if we're going to take the Bible seriously, then we have to take the disunity of the texts seriously as well, which to me is, again, part of the fun, but not for some people. They just want it to be like one reliable story and they can wave it in other people's faces and go, see, this is how it was. All right. So now but as you say, there is nothing that, specific in any of the biographies of Herod which would have suggested that he did try to kill all the children, or that Jesus fled to Egypt with Mary and Joseph, as it says in the Matthew text. Let's get beyond that a little bit, and let me ask you about that next bit of the biblical narrative, which is there any archaeological evidence that has been unearthed in the town of Nazareth or Bethlehem, which makes specific references to Mary and Joseph and a child named Jesus?
Yes and no. So
okay.
Yes, in general terms. No, if we're looking for a first century inscription, you know, defining some exact building. But this is where some of the early traditions come in. And let me just talk about the Byzantines, you know, the early Christian churches that were built and how those got chosen and why. So let's look at Bethlehem. All right. Bethlehem, archaeologically, we can say it was a little village in the first century. Okay. So that fits. Believe it or not, there are people who were trying to say Bethlehem didn't even exist at that time. Therefore, you know, let's throw out the whole story.
If I remember my Hebrew, Bethlehem means Bethlehem, house of bread, right?
Yeah, probably, unless it's coming originally from a Canaanite word that
right.
might be connecting to one of their gods. But yes, in
okay.
Hebrew, it should be house of bread. Yep. Okay. And indeed, there's fields around there, although a lot of what they were doing was shepherding, too.
Okay. But growing wheat and making bread would have been like, I mean, it's like the most normal thing in the world. It's like saying there could be no town in Illinois named, Farmersville or something. Like, it's like the most, or, you know, what I'm saying, it's not a magical sounding name. It's a very common, it would be a super simple thing to say, like Center City or something, because that would be the place where people brought their wheat. It was ground, it was turned into bread, and then they went back to their houses.
Yeah, and at that time, it was basically this tiny suburb of Jerusalem.
Right.
So, you know, you can walk to Bethlehem from Jerusalem in ancient times in 30 minutes or so. But let's talk about the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. So, allegedly, it's built over the cave where Jesus was born. So how do they get that? The church was built in the 4th century during the reign of Constantine. So after Constantine became a Christian and he legalized Christianity with the Edict of Milan, he wanted to build these churches. But he didn't just want to build church buildings. He actually wanted to build churches at or over significant historical locations in order to commemorate and preserve them. And so he sent people off to do investigations. And he sent his mother, Helena, right. and his architect, Zenobius. And they went and they talked to the community of Christians in Bethlehem and Jerusalem and so on and so forth. And they asked them, hey, do we know where this happened? Can you show me this? And so they took them to the places. And, you know, you might think that, well, how in the world do they remember where that was if it was, you know, 270 years later, 300 years later, et cetera? But we got to look back into that time and realize that Jerusalem, first of all, that it was still not that big of a city in the first century. 60 to 100,000 people, probably. The community of Christians was essentially there continuously, except for a few years during the first Jewish revolt against Rome. And they remembered where some of these important things happened, because stuff like the resurrection of Jesus, for example, or the birth, those are incredibly important in Christianity. And so that was just passed down, you know, it happened down the block there. And they then, in the second century, this is where it gets super interesting to me, Hadrian, Emperor Hadrian, he wanted to get rid of Christianity, essentially.
Right.
But he had seen that previous emperors had not been successful. They had tried things, you know, Nero tried persecution, Domitian tried some of that too, of course. And Hadrian saw it didn't work. So at first he thought he was going to debate these Christians. He was a lover of Greek philosophy, and he actually had a debate with a couple of Christian bishops in Athens. That didn't work. So he came up with an idea to essentially syncretize Christianity with Roman religion, or just build over it with Roman religion. So he erected temples at important historical Christian sites, including the tomb of Jesus and the nativity spot. So when Constantine's people got there, they found Roman temples and shrines in several of these locations associated with Jesus. And to me, Hadrian unwittingly helped preserve those locations. You know, he's much closer in time to Jesus.
Right.
He was 100 years after Jesus rather than 300. So I think that a lot of those old Byzantine churches actually have a very strong argument in terms of geographic location. I think that the tomb of Jesus and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I would say that's a sure thing. As far as the Nativity Church and the cave where Jesus was born, that's, you know, I put that more in the category of maybe. It's,
right.
It's plausible, but
right.
It's more difficult, I think, to substantiate.
You bring up so many good points, and thank you again, Titus, for being such a great conversation partner on this. The book is Unearthing the Bible. We need to note something that we know from the character of Constantine, that the subtext of his search was also uniformity. That he had no interest in the idea of the religious conflict under, you know, in his empire. And so I think it's fair to say that there was towns were incentivized to find a way to connect themselves to the Jesus story, especially in light of his mother's devotion to Christianity. And that, you know, like we might look at today, you know, birthplace of Jesse James, or places along the Old West Trail, which may or may not actually have been the place where something historical and cool happened, but local people claim it because it's good for business, it's good tourism, and it gives the town a name and a purpose and a place in the timeline of history. Don't you think that we have to take that into consideration for where these churches, these Byzantine churches, were placed?
In some cases, yes, but in others, I think that he wanted to have an important church built, yes, but they went and they consulted with the local Christians who, again, like I said, had a continuous presence there. There was a Roman temple that had been purposely built over some of these locations. You know, in others, we have some good descriptions and geographic information, too. Like, we have the same phenomena happening at the Pool of Siloam and the Pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. And we know that those were ritual pools.
Baths.
They were used for ritual bathing, right?
Right.
And when those were excavated, you know, they found underneath the church, here's a first century Jewish ritual bathing pool.
Love that. Hang on to that. And because this is also where we're going coming up, because I want to ask about revelation. I want to ask about other things about the New Testament too. Enjoying this conversation so much. Hope you are. If you have a question or comment, hang on to that. We'll get to it at the beginning of next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so biblical archaeology, as we're hearing from Dr. Titus Kennedy, endlessly fascinating and endless work, for that matter. And you never know when somebody might find something new that could change history, much like the way he spoke about it last hour, where just something that somebody had in the shoeboxes of histories in their father's closet might just show up one day at a museum. It could happen at any moment. It's part of what makes it so exciting, being able to verify, not necessarily in a sense of proving what is in the Bible is all true, but verifying that there is a historical basis for some things which other people might consider just to be a plain old myth. This is, you know, part of the research that goes on everywhere. Universities with people who are atheists study this material because it's just endlessly fascinating. Here at the Kansas State University, these are conversations that go on all the time in the religious department. And so it is that this book may be helpful for people who are just getting caught up on what are the archaeological discoveries of our times. And so we'll pick it up right where we left off. What can we know about the New Testament? Seems like most of the real objective discoveries speak to ancient Israel, Judea, but what about the Christian part of what we call the Holy Bible? We'll find out more about that next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So looking for archaeological evidence that supports the Christian stories of the New Testament, Titus Kennedy and I have been talking about a couple of different aspects of it. And I think it's a fair point you were making just before we went to the break, that a lot of effort was being made to highlight local features, local buildings or local topography, and tie that to people who are looking for evidence of the veracity of the new, you know, these new Christian claims, even up to the fourth and fifth centuries. And that, you know, these churches were being stamped over sites, like you mentioned, you know, the pool at Bethesda. But I want to back up a little bit because I think you gave short shrift to something, and this is your field, dude. I'm not like challenging you too much, but I don't know that it's a valid argument to say that just because they were locals and just because they lived at a time that was close to the events, that they would not have been inclined to exaggerate the importance of a particular location. And I give you, as support of that, the famous story of, you know, the Lincoln's log cabin birthplace, which was sent around and shown at world's fairs, and it was put on display in Washington, you know, years after his assassination. But it was also, it was built long after his death. So, you know, but people accepted it, and these people who brought it were like, yeah, we're from that part of the country. This is the cabin. We're transporting it around so people can actually see it. And there would have been no reason to doubt them, because you had no way of saying that it wasn't true, except we know now it wasn't true any more than we know that George Washington did not, in fact, pray at the chapel that's in part of the tour of Valley Forge National Park. He didn't do that. And yet much of the myth has been built around him praying at that chapel. And there were people who supported it at the time because it was a great tourist attraction. And it gave importance to that area. So that was really my point, that I like to think that these stories could be reaffirmed by locals and their traditions. I would rather find some other objective way of measuring that.
Okay, look at it this way. for certain locations. Go to the tomb of Jesus, for example. So the empty tomb, that, you know, we could argue that that is the most important location in the gospel story,
right?
The resurrected Jesus.
Roll away the stone.
That's not something that people are going to forget. So they're remembering it. They're revering it even. And that's why Hadrian builds this double temple over it to Jupiter and Venus and basically usurps it for himself. So when they took that apart, what was there? There actually was a tomb. When excavations and analysis have been done more recently, then it was a graveyard in the first century with first century tombs. And there's this arcosolium type of tomb, a single chambered tomb, which is the same type as Jesus. And that's the only single chambered tomb from that period, that type, in the Jerusalem area. So something like that, I think we can say this is solid. Again, like I was mentioning with the nativity one, I wouldn't say that, right, we can say that's super solid. Again, I'm saying maybe, but it's the general area. Okay, we know that Bethlehem's a small,
right,
town. Something like the pools of Bethesda and Siloam, I think those are pretty easy locations because the excavations show exactly what they are. They're ritual bathing pools. From the first century, we know because of things like coins found in the mortar and what, you know, when they were built, and then they went out of use in 70 AD with the destruction of the city. In the case of Bethesda, we know that that was the neighborhood, the name of the neighborhood where it was found. And also the way that John describes that pool in chapter 5 of John's gospel, he says it had 5 porticos, and when people were reading that, they didn't really know what to expect, how to imagine it. Is it this kind of weird 5-sided structure? But when it was finally found and excavated, what he was making reference to is that it had your standard 4 sides for a pool, but then the 5th portico was actually going through the middle, dividing it into upper and lower. And so that was another defining feature, I think, that really helped us say, okay, this is the location.
Love that. All right, so
that doesn't apply to every single spot.
Right.
You know,
and I hope you don't feel like I'm being...
Totally makes sense.
Right. I hope you don't feel like I'm getting up your nose too much on that.
These are good questions because, people should be aware that some of those spots where those ancient churches were built have really strong evidence, and others, we just can't say the same.
Right. Well, the same thing could be said for relics. So if there was one thing that we can talk about with regard to artifacts, biblical artifacts, would be the things that had been preserved for centuries, which some people might consider to take it sort of at face value. And yet other people might look at that and go, is that really a biblical an archaeological discovery that really dates back to biblical times, or was it more like the Middle Ages? A requisite of the building of a church was that it had to have some sort of relic, so there was good business in quote-unquote finding these relics. And some of that exists, like, for example, the nails that were used at the crucifixion, or the wood that was splintered off of the cross, or in many churches the claim that they have Jesus's baby foreskin from his bris 8 days after his birth, which, you know, for the number of churches that claim that they have it, you know, he would have to have had a foreskin like a large intestine or something, because that would have taken a lot of that. They floated around, you know, in almost a kind of relic economy at the time. So what do we know in terms of the relics and how they can be typed as being authentic you know, for a biblical archaeologist?
So when we're talking about relics, we're usually distinguishing objects from artifacts that are objects. So an artifact, we're talking more about, this is actually, or certainly, an ancient object that was found in an archaeological context, whereas a relic is some kind of item that's definitely associated with religion, but not necessarily going to be associated with history. And like you said, you know, all these different nails, all these different pieces of the cross and so forth, when that stuff's put under analysis, almost always it's shown it's not actually from the time and the place it's supposed to be.
Right.
Maybe there's some Roman nails floating around out there, but, you know, we can't say exactly what a Roman nail was used for.
Right.
But there are certainly objects, you know, artifacts, many that connect to Jesus. Probably I would say the most famous thing that is considered a relic that we could also call an archaeological artifact, I would say the Shroud of Turin fits that. Of course, there's this whole thing about radiocarbon tests, although many scientists have been arguing that they actually tested a repaired portion of it. And the thing that gets me about this artifact, this relic, is that when they did a microscopic examination of the fibers and the weave, they found that it fits this specific type that comes from Judea. Actually, we have an example that's just like it from the second century, the early second century. So,
right.
You know, that to me is like something like, well, this is actually from the place and the time. So that's a little more interesting. But
sure.
Again, it's not like it says Jesus' name on it or something.
Right. And I'm not a shroudy. So, I mean, I do find the conversation interesting, but I do, I mean, I think that at some point, I'm not sure even still what we're pursuing. I mean, is it, it doesn't really matter, at least to me as a person of faith. But that brings me, that circles back to something else I wondered about last hour is, do you ever look at the Quran and the corresponding stories from the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Bible as they appear in the Quranic narratives and look for anything that comes from them that would be informative in your research?
As far as a historical source, looking at it as a historical source for the Old Testament period, if you will, or
right.
Even for the New Testament period, I wouldn't use it as a historical source because it's so far divided from those time periods.
Right.
You know, whenever we're looking at additional historical material, we're looking for anything that is contemporaneous with the events or that comes from sometime soon after, you know, like a century after. So if I'm looking for material that connects to the New Testament, that can contextualize that, answer some questions, we're looking for stuff from the first and sometimes second century. Of course, the Old Testament period, that's a huge amount of time.
Right, before that.
But something from the 7th, 8th century AD, you know, we're going to have to say it's got records of records of records and copies, and they could have made all
right.
types of changes, and it's just not something that we could point to as a primary source.
Okay. I think that I was surprised to learn that I have this book out about leadership from a Mosaic perspective, which I co-wrote with an Israeli-born rabbi and a Pakistani-born Muslim scholar. And we wrote this book together called How Millennials Can Get Us Out of the Mess We're In, and it's about leadership lessons from the life of Moses. And in the part of the research for that, I discovered is that Cecil B. DeMille used part of the Quranic narrative of the Exodus story in the research to frame the movie The Exodus with Charlton Heston, which I thought was really interesting. They were trying to find, not so much that they were trying to synthesize the texts, but they were looking for every interesting detail that they could to bring the story to life. Not biblical archaeology, I realize, but that's part of what inspired the question and for me to ask.
That's interesting. I wasn't even aware of that.
Yeah. And I particularly like the way that they tell the crucifixion story in the Quran, and I've mentioned this before, that the Arabic word for murder is what they use to describe what happened to Jesus, that he was murdered. And we don't use that. We don't have the Greek equivalent for that in the New Testament. We talk about him being killed or crucified, but not murdered. And I thought, wow, that stays with me all the time. I wish we talked about it more, because it was a murder, and he was tortured and then he was murdered. Why do we allow it to be antiseptically framed as killed? I don't know. I found that interesting. All right. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think probably because of the context in which it happened. One, the political context, it was supposed to be a sanctioned execution.
Right.
And then, usually we don't refer to those kinds of things as murder, whether or not they may actually, morally be that. And then, of course, the other context is the religious context, and we're looking at the spiritual side of it and the fulfillment of prophecy. And, that's a good point, though.
Because
on sort of moral grounds, you can look at it that way.
Right, and we would if it were a rebel government.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we look at governments being recognized by the UN or something like this, but in a lot of ways, this wasn't particularly state-sanctioned. This was, according to the Roman account, it's Pontius Pilate pushing off the responsibility for the murder onto the temple leaders, and the temple leaders using the excuse of the Romans to get it done and having them do it for them. So it really is sort of extra governmental or outside of the realm of government. It was really like a favor. Yeah, we'll kill this guy for you. And that's part of what I think why it's so interesting to say murder, because if that happened today in a country like El Salvador, if it happened in Iraq or in Iran or one of our, or North Korea, we would say they got murdered. There's no other word for it. Well, let me ask you about two things before we get to the phones. One of those is Pontius Pilate and his part in the story of Christ, which is not part of the Christmas story, but still an interesting character nonetheless. And what archaeological evidence exists for the execution of Jesus, the murder of Jesus, that you can find as a biblical archaeologist?
So those two things, they connect, but they're distinct also. So
right.
Pilate himself is attested by two archaeological artifacts and then by three ancient authors outside of the New Testament. Many people might not be aware that Paul actually mentions Pilate, but we've got the Gospels, we've got Paul talking about him, we've got three Roman historians, and then we have Pilate's own materials, something that's often just called the Pilate Stone. It was found at Caesarea Maritima on the coast, which was the Roman political capital of Judea province. And this stone was inscribed in Latin, and it gave Pilate's name and title, the prefect of Judea, the governor of Judea.
All right, I'm going to ask you to hold right there because we're running up at the top of the hour. We'll start there, and then we'll also start to fold in the calls for Dr. Titus Kennedy. Unearthing the Bible questions for him next on Coast to Coast AM.